part two, and what I want to do today is give you kind of an outline of where we're going, but also introduce the first topic. So what we're going to do now in this part of the course is we're going to broaden out from what we talked about in the first term, which was basically the role of the intellectual, social intellectual role, and in the course of that, we looked at the way in which intellectuals relate to other knowledge producers in societies, so philosophers, scientists, journalists, experts of various sorts, and even religious specialists, theologians, people of that kind. Now, what in this term, we're going to be focusing mostly on this book here, the Knowledge Book, which consists of about 40 entries of about 1,000 to 3,000 words, which provide a kind of an account of different things that are relating to the concept of knowledge. So, broadly speaking, this covers philosophical and sociological matters. Now, what I plan to do, first of all, is the whole book will not be covered in this term. Okay, so really, what's going to be covered are going to be selected essays, which I will indicate each week. You will be receiving, hopefully by the end of the day, the course outline, but I can already tell you what will be relevant for the seminar this coming Monday will be the entries on the university and on free inquiry. Okay? Because in a sense, that is where the role of the intellectual most naturally interfaces with the other roles having to do with knowledge production in society. And so what I want to do in the lecture primarily today is to talk about this business of free inquiry, right? Because one of the things about the intellectual that's supposedly very important is that the intellectual is autonomous, right? The intellectual is not someone who, as it were, thinks for hire or is in some way committed to some fundamental assumptions that he or she will never change, but rather the intellectual is in some sense seeking the truth and following the truth wherever it will go, and typically speaks truth to power, which is one of the things that has made the role of the intellectual such a dangerous role in society. Okay, and so then the question arises, okay, if this is such a dangerous role, is there any way of protecting it? And one of the things that I suggested in last term was that historically, an important way of protecting intellectual freedom has been through the institution of tenure at universities. Right, that is to say that after a certain probation period, right, where your performance in your teaching and your research is scrutinized by your senior colleagues, you are then hopefully allowed the chance to hold a position in the university in perpetuity, right, or at least until the retirement age. And that is to say, you cannot be fired. You may not get a raise every year. Okay, your quality of life may decline over time and all that, that's true. Okay, but you can't get fired. In particular, you can't get fired for what you do once you're in this position. So if you say certain things that aggravate people, right, you go into areas of research that are considered very controversial, right, you cannot be gotten rid of. Okay, and I spoke a little bit about this last term. And the idea of tenure was very much designed with that kind of conception in mind. Namely, and I think the thing that's really important to keep in mind about the institution of tenure in universities is that it was created against the backdrop of societies that did not have a generalized right to free speech. Okay? So in other words, this particular kind of intellectual freedom that allows you to teach and write whatever you want was largely a guild right, right? The right of the profession. Not, as it were, an extension of a general human right, but a specific right to people who are engaged in this profession. And see, this is where the probation period becomes very important, right? Because basically, before you are given this right to intellectual freedom, you have to, in some sense, prove yourself. You have to show that you can, in fact, sort of perform this intellectually free role in a responsible manner. So in whatever years it takes, 3 years, 6 years, it varies, right? You're under scrutiny, but then after that, you get a free pass. Okay? And the country most responsible for this kind of conception of intellectual freedom was Germany. Okay? Prussia, in particular, where Berlin is, in the early 19th century. And it's very much a part of the foundation of the modern university is this idea of tenure, which is this sort of institutionalization of intellectual freedom. Okay? Now, again, this is against the backdrop of a country that did not have generalized free speech. So it wasn't that everyone could be doing whatever they wanted. So, for example, if you wanted to run a newspaper in that time, you needed to get a license from the government. And if you started printing things that went against the government policy, you could be shut down. And if you, in some way, cast doubt on belief in God or the authority of the Lutheran Church, they could shut you down for that, too. And, in fact, that's what happened to our dear friend Karl Marx. Okay, Karl Marx is a great example of someone, right, who was university trained as a lawyer, but did not, was not able to get a university appointment, okay, because he would not pledge allegiance to the church, okay? He started a newspaper, and once the newspaper started to be critical of the government policy, he got shut down, and he was forced to move to France. And he caused trouble there, and he moved to Britain, and he still caused trouble, but in Britain is a tolerant country, okay? And that's the history of Karl Marx, basically, in a nutshell, and he's buried, as you know, in Highgate Cemetery in North London. Right next to Herbert Spencer, by the way, the social Darwinist. That's another story. So what we see here is that this idea of intellectual freedom, institutionalized in tenure, is a guild right of academics and universities. Now, this idea that intellectual freedom should be attached to universities, okay, is actually, while the Germans, in particular Humboldt, one of the most famous theorists and practitioners of academia, Humboldt, you have probably run across him. At some point, he was the rector of the University of Berlin when it got refounded in 1810 and was the minister for higher education in Germany during that early 19th century period. Now, Humboldt's idea, what he was thinking of doing, what his idea was to basically take the Enlightenment, right, which had taken place in the 18th century. So Humboldt, right, is basically born in the middle of the Enlightenment, and in a sense there's a kind of a nostalgia for that, you might say, because if you know the history here, right, the Enlightenment takes place in the 18th century. It leads to an enormous amount of ferment. I was talking last term about how it led to a rise in newspapers, but at the same time, all of this ferment, all of this discussion about politics and science and religion and all of this led to an enormous amount of discontent in society, which of course destabilized the monarchies of Europe and led to revolutions. And of course the French Revolution being the really major revolution that in a sense was done in the name of the Enlightenment, but essentially led to this reign of terror and a kind of new imperialism exemplified by Napoleon, who wanted to conquer all of Europe. Okay, and so in a sense the Enlightenment had come, you know, seemed to have been a disaster in that sense, right? But Humboldt believed that there was something quite salvageable in the Enlightenment, but that the Enlightenment could not be a free-roaming thing. It couldn't just be something that was a creature of the marketplace the way it was in the 18th century when guys like Voltaire and Rousseau and Diderot and all these French guys were publishing encyclopedias that were bought on subscription and writing pamphlets and newspapers and stuff like that, that you couldn't have really intellectual freedom that also allowed for social stability if it was subject to just market forces. What you needed was some kind of proper institutionalization, and so the founding of the university, the modern founding of the university, was basically dedicated to that, to somehow bring the Enlightenment in, contain it, as it were, discipline it, you might say, right, and that was the point. And Humboldt's idea was very much one of, and I think disciplining the Enlightenment is a really good way of putting it, because what he wanted to do, basically, was to use the Enlightenment for purposes of building the nation-state. So he's the guy who really comes up with the idea that the way in which you build up your society is through education. Right? We talk about living in a knowledge society today, right? It seems like, you know, the buzzword all over the place, right? Information society, knowledge economy, all these things, these words, right? Well, Humboldt's the first guy to really see this, okay? Because he thought, well, what you need to do is basically make the university a central part of society's normal reproduction processes, okay? But unlike the ancient universities, you know, medieval universities, the ones that had existed prior to the Enlightenment, the kind of knowledge that is going to be promoted in the universities is not simply going to be knowledge of tradition, you know, the Bible, theology, all this kind of stuff, but rather it's going to be the cutting edge stuff, the stuff that the people, the young people who are going to be living in the world tomorrow are going to need in order to take the country forward. Okay? So this is where the whole idea of trying to bring the Enlightenment into the university is concerned, because the Enlightenment is all about opening doors and opening minds and all the rest of it. Bringing in new things, getting rid of the old. And Humboldt's idea was, this can work to build the society. This doesn't have to be seen as a completely nihilistic, negative force the way it came across during the French Revolution. Okay? So this was Humboldt's idea. Okay? And in this respect, Humboldt is very much influenced by the greatest of the modern philosophers, Immanuel Kant. Have all of you heard of Immanuel Kant? I hope so. Is there someone who hasn't heard of him? I guess, given the way I've asked the question, no one's going to put their hands up. This man is a very important figure, just in general. I mean, one of the 5 or 10 most influential thinkers of all time. Okay? And he's the person who really Humboldt had in the back of his mind in terms of the way in which enlightenment can be used as a force for really making society more progressive. Right? Now, see, Germany, Prussia in particular, is in a very peculiar situation in the beginning of the 19th century that's relevant here. Right? Because remember, it's all about Napoleon in the beginning of the 19th century. Napoleon trying to conquer Europe, and Napoleon getting into all these battles, right, on the continent in particular, and against the Germans. And the Germans, as you know, are completely disorganized, lots of principalities, divided along all kinds of family, religious lines. They all sort of speak the same language and have a common culture, but they're all over the map otherwise. So, and Napoleon's just basically, you know, kind of conquering everything. And then Napoleon gets crowned the Holy Roman Emperor, and, you know, things start to get rough. So what Humboldt's thinking about is what's the most effective way in the long term to counteract this, right, so that Germany, right, can maintain its autonomy as a nation with its own culture, its own identity, its own sense of progress. And so it's with that in mind that universities become these important kind of mainstays for the society. Okay, and Humboldt's idea, right, was that basically, first of all, you don't have to take holy orders in order to work in the university. I mean, if you may know that in this country, for example, you know, if you wanted to be a don in Oxford or Cambridge until the end of the 19th century, you had to be a member of the Church of England. Okay, you know, this, you know, Humboldt removed all that, right? That all the religious qualifications were removed. I mean, this didn't say you could go around and badmouth, you know, the Lutheran Church. No, you could get removed for that, but you didn't have to actually be a member. And that was an important move right there. Okay. And over the course of the 19th century, the universities in Germany typically did perform a role that they are now more very much familiar with doing now, namely as a way of integrating traditionally disenfranchised elements of the society into the society's power structure, right? So the idea of bringing in ethnic minorities, in particular the relevant ones in Germany are Jews, bringing in you know, Catholics into Protestant areas, and eventually in the end of the 19th century bringing in women, okay? All of these things serve, as it were, to create a kind of new class of people who will be the leaders of the society. Okay? And the way you do this, of course, is by primarily using examinations as the means by which you select who is going to actually enter the university. Okay. And that cuts across a lot of the traditional class and status barriers. And as the 19th century progresses in Germany, universities grow larger and larger and more numerous, taking in larger and larger percentage of the society, so that by the time Germany is unified, 1870, under Bismarck, right, you have something, some enormous number, percentage of males going to universities in Germany that only gets matched by the United States in the 1930s. Okay, so the university here is getting a very enormous kind of social role, and it's a role of enlightenment. So how is enlightenment supposed to work here? In what sense are we talking about institutionalizing intellectual freedom? Because that seems to be a strange idea. Because, you know, if you think about what we do in universities, the way universities are organized, they do seem to be these very in many ways hierarchical, certainly very structured kinds of formal institutions, right? We not only give you lectures, but we examine you, we give you numbers, your lives are ruined by them. You know, I mean, this kind of stuff doesn't seem like intellectual freedom. Okay. Now, there's one aspect of this intellectual freedom that I haven't spoken about yet, but is very important and is typically neglected in the discussions of the history of this concept, even when we're talking about universities. And it's one I think is very relevant to you guys, and that is, what kinds of freedoms are we talking about? Now, there is the freedom to teach. I mean, the way it was put in the German context was there are complementary freedoms in the university. Complementary, that is to say, one has to give to the other, which means that there are obligations as well, mutual obligations. And these are between the teacher and the student. So in other words, it's not just the teacher, somebody like me, who has intellectual freedom. That's what we're familiar with, I think. But students have intellectual freedom, too. Now, this is an amazing idea. Okay, students have intellectual freedom. All right? They have the freedom to learn, which is different from the freedom to teach. They're complementary. They're not the same. Okay, now, what does this mean? Okay? Well, I mean, the point here is this goes back to the kind of original establishment of universities in the Middle Ages. This is a principle that goes back, so let's say, to the 13th century. So it goes back, right, 500-600 years before Humboldt gets on the scene. And it has a lot to do with the kind of legal entity that a university is. Okay? And a university is basically one of the first examples of what we call corporation. That is to say, a legal entity that is allowed to exist in perpetuity for promoting certain kinds of goals that are above and beyond the self-interest of the people who happen to be part of it at any given time. Okay? So you think about corporations today like businesses, right? You got shareholders, right? You know, and I get appointed as a CEO. What's my job? My job is to make money for the company, not make money for myself. Of course, if I make money for myself, that's good. But the point is, I'm there primarily to make money for the people who have hired me. Okay? And so there's a sense in which there is a kind of function to this corporation that goes above and beyond the self-interest of the individuals to the members of it. Okay? So, for example, I go into academia. Why do I want to go into academia? Oh, I want to be famous and influential. Oh, that's nice, but that doesn't sustain the institution. What sustains the institution is a particular relationship between teaching and learning. Okay, and that requires a certain freedom to be allowed on both sides. Now, what is this business of students' freedom to learn? Well, obviously, teachers will say all kinds of things in the classroom, right? And in a sense, they cannot be stopped from saying them. Let's say, intellectual freedom zero, degree zero. You can't stop the professor from saying something. But still, after you listen to all these professors talking, you may say, I'm missing something here. There's something that's not being said, and I want to find out about it. The university has to give you the space to do that. And so traditionally what that's meant in universities is the allowance of students to create their own reading groups, their own study groups amongst themselves, self-organize, right? And then petition the university to get some kind of credit for having done it, right? Saying, well, look, we've been reading these books, we've been doing this kind of work, it's academically credible stuff, nobody's lecturing on it, we want to get some credit for it. And this is very common practice in continental Europe, and in fact, the student revolts that periodically have taken place in universities over the past two centuries, right? You think about, for example, the 1960s being the kind of the famous one, you know, within living memory, though probably not living memory of any of you here, is that was largely the result of people, students, getting together and actually looking into stuff for themselves, not getting a response from university administrators who didn't want to recognize the kind of stuff they were doing, and then revolting. Okay? And this is this is something that's very much part of the history of the university, and if you look at the rhetoric that the students use when they revolt, it is a rhetoric of our freedom to learn is being infringed. Because the professors aren't teaching the stuff, and they're not allowing us to learn it. Okay? Now, in the United States recently, this idea of the freedom to learn as being part of the student's intellectual freedom has been given kind of a new lease on life, interestingly enough, from the political right. Okay? Now, why is this? Well, as you know, in this country too, and certainly in the United States, the average professor is a member of the left, is liberal left. Okay, so that, and this is true just about everywhere actually, that the politics and the general kind of worldview orientation of academics tends to be to the left of the rest of society. Okay, now students tend to be representative of the society. Okay, especially when they come into the university. After they leave, it's a somewhat different story. We get to indoctrinate you a little bit. You know, so you tend to move to the left once you leave the university. But when you get here, you typically kind of just like the rest of society. Okay, so the question then arises, okay, here are all these primarily conservative students in the United States, you've got to imagine, right? Many of them probably quite religious people, right? Coming into the classroom, and they're listening to some fire-breathing Marxist, or feminist, or multiculturalist, or something like this, right? And not only in one course, but in every course. There are different flavors. Some are postmodern, some aren't, you know, but they're all pretty much to the left of them, okay? And the students say, I don't see myself in any of these courses. This is not the world I relate to. You are basically debunking and demystifying everything I believe in. Where is the knowledge for someone like me? Your message to me is I've got to turn into a different person. Okay, and of course a lot of academics will say, you got it. Bingo. Right? The reason why you come to university is to discard your family. End of story. What's the, you know, no problem. And some people are quite explicit about that in the classroom. So what happens then is the students then, with the help of their friendly neoconservative student organizer, decide that their freedom to learn is being infringed. And that their views, you know, that the sorts of knowledge and the views that they need to have taught to them because of where they're coming from and where they're likely to go in society is just not being represented in the classroom. Okay? Now the problem emerges at this point, because what do you do about this, okay? And what a lot of the people on the right in the United States want to do is they want to basically force the professors to teach other points of view. And that sounds harmless enough in a way, okay? But actually that isn't what, because the problem then is you get the response from the professors, which is of course the response that they've been giving throughout the ages, and you're restricting our intellectual freedom. Because our intellectual freedom, we teach the truth as we think it is, and we just don't think this conservative stuff is true. We think it's a lot of hogwash, and we're not going to teach it. I don't care if most of the students already believe it. We're not here to teach fairy tales, you know? So there's a serious issue here, right? And so the historic way of dealing with this problem was for the students to actually organize themselves, to actually have funds through the university, let's say to invite relevant speakers who represent other points of view, to be able to get books, and potentially to petition to get credit. And at some liberal arts colleges in the United States today, I'm not sure this practice applies in this country at all, but it is possible that that if enough students get together and come up with a course outline, you know, that represents a body of knowledge that's not being represented anywhere in the departments that they're part of, right? And they actually have some serious, you know, like we're going to write these essays and, you know, and all the rest of it, and they go through an academic committee, they can get credit for it. Even though this was not something put on the books by the faculty, it was put on the books by the students. Okay? Now that's a much more traditional way of handling this problem. Rather than actually to get the academics to change what they're teaching, the students organize and go through the channels and basically create their own course and get credit for it. Okay? See, this has all kinds of... See, one reason why this is a very touchy question about the relationship between the freedom to teach and the freedom to learn is because think about this from the standpoint of an academic who's on probation. Okay? Because these are the guys who are really... They're sort of on the crossfire, right? Because, okay, you get some, you know, some young leftist gets hired, you know, he's teaching to all these conservative students in the audience, the students start to complain, okay, and what's he going to do? In one sense, you know, he would say his intellectual freedom is being infringed by having to teach stuff he doesn't believe, but on the other hand, he's not tenured yet, okay, and so he's not tenured yet, what does he do? What's his status in all this? Does he have to kind of cater to these students, to curry favor? And see, in the United States, this issue is aggravated in a way that will probably get aggravated here, too, in the future, because student evaluations are very sophisticated things in the United States. If you go on websites, you can find out about them. I mean, they make the stuff that goes on in this country look like, you know, like a joke. I mean, they're very sophisticated in the United States. Students become very savvy consumers of professors about the way they sort of gauge them and so forth. And these things get used to decide whether someone will get tenure. Okay. Now, from the standpoint of a kind of traditional view of academic freedom that somebody like Humboldt was promoting, this undermines academic freedom. Because what it basically does is it encourages the professor to teach to the audience, right? To kind of cater, right? Because you want to keep your ratings up. Okay. And in fact, in the United States, you do have a lot of that kind of teaching. I mean, it's difficult to say it's intellectual freedom, because if the professor's not complaining about it, how do you have a charge of intellectual freedom being violated, right? So if you've got a lot of professors who, because they want to keep their jobs, are quite happy to pacify students by telling them things they want to hear, who's the wiser that intellectual freedom's being violated? Because this is the interesting point, right? I mean, we normally judge whether intellectual freedom is being violated because the person being violated complains. But of course your intellectual freedom could be violated just by virtue of being in a certain kind of social situation where the only way you can survive is by catering to other people's views. Right? In which case then, from a sort of systemic or structural standpoint, your intellectual freedom is being violated regardless of what you are willing to put up with. Now, Max Weber, okay, Max Weber, the great sociologist, you know, he wrote this, he delivered his very famous speech toward the end of his life called Science as a Vocation. You've probably heard of it. If you haven't read it already, it's used in many different courses in this department. And Weber in that speech has some discussion about this problem in Germany, not because they were having student evaluations, but in terms of the numbers of students who would gravitate to various lectures. Okay? And the worry that a lot of professors had that because all the students were gravitating to, let's say, the Marxist professors, you know, the ones who had very sort of explicit political views, that other professors will feel under pressure in order to fill their classrooms to kind of say things that will draw students. Okay? And Weber is very much against this. Right? And in fact, he believes that the kinds of professors who actually say things that attract students and perform in a way that's quite clear that they're catering to the students, telling them the kinds of things they want to hear, getting them kind of intrigued on the students' own turf without challenging them necessarily, that those professors are in fact undermining intellectual freedom. Okay? They're creating a kind of corrupt environment. And a lot of Weber's discussion about value freedom and value neutrality, which these are terms that he's associated with in his writings, this is part of what he's worried about, right? Namely, that there's a sense in which, let's say, a very kind of strong, fire-breathing Marxist who's kind of catering to all of the revolutionary instincts of his students who are very much frustrated with the way the German government is going, because now you've got to realize here, Weber delivers this speech in 1918. What happened in 1918? Germany lost World War I, so Germany's on the skids, and so he's giving this lecture, and he's noticing that a lot of his colleagues, right, are basically trying to drum up some very pro-German, typically on the left, okay, feeling to get it beyond all this, and the students are kind of frustrated about losing the war. There's a lot of way, you know, you can really rev people up. And Weber objects to this totally, this whole way of operating, because it demeans intellectual freedom. And in particular, what he thinks happens is that the student really is not put in a position to make a free choice about what he or she should think. Okay? And so Weber has this way of thinking about intellectual freedom that, in a sense, you've got to always be policing the boundary between the freedom to teach and the freedom to learn. It's a boundary that needs to be policed so both sides are respected. Okay? And what happens with these fire-breathing Marxists is they overstep the line, right? And they basically present this, you know, kind of point of view to the students as a totalizing point of view. They're already inclined to believe it, and they just get sucked into the whole ideology. And at that point, everything's been compromised in intellectual freedom because the professor is just playing to the gallery, and the students, right, are basically not put in a position where they have to kind of think critically about the various choices that are available to them in society. They're just given this kind of one big Marxist story, and they're supposed to buy it. And they buy it all too easily. So part of the value neutrality, right, from Weber's standpoint, this is Weber's way of interpreting the intellectual freedom thing, right, comes from presenting things in a way that the students, you know, where it's not clear, where the students are not being told to believe something. Right? The students are given options. And the students decide. Okay? Now, there are lots of ways of doing this. Right? I mean, I think there's a kind of a stereotype way of thinking about this whereby, you know, professor has to come across as being dry as dust and, you know, doing everything, you know, laying out 1, 2, 3, 4, you know, and basically presenting each view with equal time and the same tone of voice and all that. That kind of sense of neutrality. But that's not necessary, right? I mean, that's not really. And Weber himself, from eyewitness accounts, was apparently a very good speaker. He was a very, very impressive speaker. But stuck to his kind of way of looking at this. But it is an interesting point because we really don't think about intellectual freedom in this kind of complementary way as involving both the student's freedom to learn and the academic's freedom to teach. Because if we really took both sides of that seriously, that would have a lot of implications for how academics and students relate to each other. And it would, I think, cast a lot of doubts on stuff like student evaluation forms, especially as ways of disciplining academics. Okay. I mean, there's nothing wrong with knowing about what students think about courses. No problem there. But the problem is the way these things get used, in effect, as disciplining devices. Okay. So, we've got all this kind of issues about freedom, academic freedom here, involving students and teachers. There's another aspect to this, and that has to do with the relationship between the freedom to teach and the freedom to research on the academic side, right? Because we talk about what the job of the academic is, and Humboldt is very much on top of this issue, right, is that it's about the unity of teaching and research, right? And both of these are free activities. Now, I don't know how much attention you pay to the ways in which universities work these days. I mean, it's always interesting to, one of the most fascinating things, in a way, for an academic to do is to talk to a student about what they think a university is. Because these students have a completely different conception of university from those of us, you know, who work here. Okay? The thing that I think is worth pointing out, if it's not obvious already, is that the way in which universities are organized these days, they do a lot to undermine this idea that teaching and research is unified. Okay? Now, you may think, well, what does this idea mean in the first place? Well, I mean, the simple way, let's start with the simple way of looking at it. You do research in the areas that interest you, and then you teach them to students. And so presumably what you're going to be talking to students about are things you have thought about, done research on, that in some sense you know marginally know more about it than the student does. That's basically the idea. You do the research, and you tell students. And at that very basic sort of sense, an enlightenment function has been performed. Right? Because in the sense in which you as students did not know the stuff that I'm telling you before I told you. And that in some sense, right, I am telling you this because I think this is kind of important stuff. It's stuff you would not find out about otherwise, but nevertheless it's stuff that should inform the way you go about thinking about things. So at that very basic level, we have a sense of how freedom to research can lead to freedom to teach, and that performs an enlightenment function. Pretty straightforward at that level. But not so straightforward in practice. And in particular, you see, and this is really true in this country, more than in most places, though it's getting to be that way elsewhere. Teaching and research are evaluated in radically different ways. Okay? That's a very important point. So they're supposed to be somehow related to each other in terms of intellectual freedom of the academic, but they are evaluated radically differently. Which means that people are increasingly forced to think about these two activities as doing different things, because they're going to be measured differently. Okay? So, what do I mean? Well, research, how is it evaluated? Well, basically by publishing in these relatively technical academic journals that only other people who do research in the same area ever read. And these have, typically have technical languages, very difficult. You actually need to already have a lot of knowledge to be able to get a lot out of these articles, right? They are basically written by and for specialists. But that's pretty much what you need to do if you are going to be recognized as a researcher. You need to do that. Now, the skills that are involved in doing that, and doing that successfully, have nothing to do with being a teacher. Right? Because the whole idea of being a teacher is, on the contrary, to be able to take these difficult, technical, esoteric ideas and actually make them comprehensible to people who don't already know about them. Right? That's where the enlightenment function comes in again. Okay? And so, not surprisingly, we have this situation where we've got these very distinguished academics on the research side who are complete disasters when they open their mouths in the classroom. But similarly, you have the reverse phenomenon. Okay? So you have some people who are excellent teachers, can communicate all kinds of stuff, right? Really get the students thinking and so forth, but they have no research record at all. Okay? They can't really get into it. Right? They're the sort of people who spend all their time reading, but have a hard time writing. Probably know such people. Maybe you are such people. If you are one of those people, you're going to have a hard time in academia because it's all about writing. It really is. You think it's hard to write terms? If you think it's, if you're one of these people who really has a hard time writing papers and you're always struggling and, you just can't get the words and all the rest of it, do not go in academia. I'm sorry to say that basically that the main skill you need to have to survive in academia is a facility in writing. Okay? And then, if you're smart enough, right, you can then master the technical details and publish, yourself into a promotion. And as for the teaching, well, that'll just take care of itself. Now, you might think this is a very cynical way of operating, but in fact, this is what graduate education is like. So someone in her position, for example, trying to get a PhD, right, I mean, it's not like we're going around teaching these people how to teach, okay? These people are supposed to be focused on their research, right? She's sitting here right now because she needs to make some money.
Yeah.
I mean, And that really makes it, you know, that is, and it's not just, and it's not her fault, okay? This is a systemic problem. This is a systemic problem. So when we have PhD programs where we're training students to become academics, you know, tomorrow, right? We do not have in that training program anything on teaching. Certainly nothing at, you know, there might be a moment where somebody comes into the classroom and watches you for 30 minutes to make sure you might not make a complete fool of yourself. Yeah, there may be that, right? But what there isn't is any kind of in-depth kind of knowledge of pedagogy, you know, namely what works, what doesn't work, how do you communicate with people, how do you make these ideas clear, right? There is not that kind of teaching going on of how to teach. Okay? All the training you get in a doctoral program is how to do research. You learn different methods you need to do research. You learn how to write up papers for publication. Right? You learn those kinds of skills. And those are the skills that you will primarily need to have in order to do well in the academic job market today, even though most academic jobs are primarily teaching jobs still. Okay? And this is very weird. But it's true. Alright? Now this is, you know, why are we in this kind of situation? I mean, there are a lot of reasons, but I think one thing that needs to be made clear is that it's a kind of pathological situation, right? In the old days, you know, and when I say the old days, I mean, let's say, 25 years ago and before, all right? One thing that used to make, that used to ensure that this problem didn't happen was that you didn't need a PhD in order to be able to teach at a university. Okay, PhD is, as I've just been describing, and it always has been, a research degree. Right? You do a PhD because you want to do advanced research in a given area. That's always been true about PhDs. PhD has never been a teaching degree. Typically, the certification for teaching has been the master's degree. And this is what master's means. Master's means you have mastery over a subject matter. So you get a master's in sociology, means you have covered all the different topics, and you can now teach it. Right? And typically master's degrees, right, have historically had coursework and maybe some essay writing, but typically relatively minimal, more coursework. Okay? And that was the way it was in this country until about 25 years ago. So when I started here as a professor, 1994, in the place that I was professor at first was Durham. And Durham being kind of a very old school kind of place, half of my colleagues did not have PhDs. You know, this is a very traditionally teaching-oriented place. Okay? But what's happened over the course of the last 25 years is that we get this phenomena that I think I've mentioned already in the course, this kind of credentials creep, right? Where there's a sense in which you start requiring more and more degrees, more and more certification for people to get certain kinds of jobs. Largely because the job market gets too big and you need ways of discriminating people. So what you do is you make it harder and harder for people to get the jobs that they could have gotten in previous generations with less qualifications. And that's pretty much why we use the PhD now as a qualification for a teaching job in academia, even though PhD training gives you no training in teaching. Okay? It's a very weird phenomenon, but this is the way it goes. Now, Humboldt had a certain additional way of thinking about the relationship between research and teaching that performed a kind of enlightenment function. I have my own spin on this, which I want to introduce to you because I think in a way it kind of updates this for our current time. And so I'm going to write this on the board here and explain it. Here is the creative destruction of social capital. Now, first of all, let me start off with this phrase of creative destruction. Are people familiar with this phrase? Just generally, not in the context of my phrase, but in the general. Where does that phrase, generally speaking, come from? Creative destruction. Anyone here ever, is anyone here in business studies? No? Good for you. This is creative destruction is a phrase that's often used to define what an entrepreneur is. Okay? And it's a phrase that comes from one of the great economists of the 20th century, Joseph Schumpeter. Very interesting figure. Austrian, who taught the latter part of his career at Harvard, wrote a very famous book in 1942 called Capitalism, Socialism, and Democracy. And he's also the person responsible for the concept of the entrepreneur. That's such a big deal now in the business. The entrepreneur is this person who basically reconfigures markets by introducing new products, right? Schumpeter's main example was Henry Ford, automotive pioneer, right? And what makes and what Ford did was to creatively destroy the market for transport. Okay, now what the creative destruction meant was, first of all, Henry Ford just didn't add a new product to the market, but rather he changed what the market was about. Right? In other words, he changed the standards that people used to evaluate products in the market. Because you think about it, before the automobile, what are we talking about? We're talking horses, right? We're talking stagecoaches, right? All those kinds of things, those kind of 19th century modes of transport. Okay? In terms of what individuals might be not trains and things like that, but things that individuals might ride, or drive. And when you bring the automobile in as a competitor to the horse, okay, both of them are, personalized transport, but the whole idea of what transport is and what's it about radically changes. Right? And what matters changes. And, so not surprisingly, as soon as the automobile gets into the market, horses are out of the picture. I mean, that's the striking thing, is that the cars catch on very fast. Right? So that's creative destruction of the market, because what you do is you basically change the market so radically that people think about it in a totally different way, so that your product isn't just the best product in the market, your product exemplifies the market. Your product sets the standard for the market. Okay? And that's what makes an entrepreneur different from just, another kind of person who brings a new product to a market. Because most people, right, when they come up with new products, and this includes most of the stuff that gets patented, right, they're basically making just marginal improvements on already existing things. Right? Whereas the entrepreneur gets you to think about what you're doing in a really different way. So if you think, you look about information technology, all this IT stuff, right? And the way in which people are thinking about different ways of configuring, the way in which information is transmitted and communicated and so forth, and the different sorts of gadgets and forms of entertainment you can have, where your computer can become your television, this kind of thing. This is all the stuff of entrepreneurship, right? Because what constantly is going on is, right, these guys are trying to get you to think about the way you relate to these various things you need. I need news. I need access to the internet, in different ways. Because that's creative destruction understood in that kind of business sense. Now, see, academics are also engaged in a kind of creative destruction when they do research. All right. But what are we talking about here? Well, first of all, you have to start off with the idea that in order to do research, you need to organize a lot of resources. And we're talking about in the contemporary period now, so right now. So that means you need money. You need backers of various sorts. You often need political approval. You need recipients, that is to say, people who are likely to find what you're doing interesting and be willing to support and to promote it once it comes out, right? So you think about this especially in the fields that are, more scientifically and technologically based. But to a certain extent, all academic fields have this. So what you need to do is you need to forge some kind of social capital. That's what the term that we use for this, right? Which is basically this kind of networking of people who have different interests, but who, in a sense, can mutually benefit each other. And that's how you have to think about a research project, so that when you file a research application today, even for a government-based grant in this country, you have to talk about who the users and beneficiaries are. You have to talk about whether they're partners, right? And that lays out the whole social capital network for your research. And then they judge you whether you should get the grant on the basis of that, okay? Now, if that was where the story ended, then research would just become basically private property, essentially. Namely, it would just belong to the people who invested in the research. In other words, that social capital network, which is finite, only includes certain kinds of groups, individuals, and so forth, would be the only ones to have access to the research. And intellectual property, this move that we're increasingly making toward turning academic research into intellectual property, encourages that way of thinking, actually. But that goes against the whole Enlightenment function of universities, which is to take this knowledge that has been gathered or produced under restricted conditions and make it more publicly available. And to do that, you have to creatively destroy that initial cluster of interests that enabled the research to happen, which means you've got to publicize the research. You have to get it out of the specialist journals. You have to get it out of the corporate offices that commissioned it. You have to make it more publicly and widely available so that people who were not involved in producing the research initially nevertheless have access to it and are able to do something with it themselves. And that's what teaching's about. Teaching basically takes knowledge that would otherwise be in the hands of just a few specialists and makes it publicly available. Okay? The reason why we have introductory courses and textbooks and stuff like that, if you look in the reference sections of these textbooks, they're full of technical articles. But the textbook is written in a way that's meant to be accessible, and the teacher is even there to make it even more accessible. And what you do then is you break up that little power base that has formed from the research community. Okay? So that social capital base of researchers, funders, policymakers, that is broken apart from teaching if knowledge doesn't become intellectual property, but is allowed free passage in the classroom. So there, the research, right, creates social capital, the teaching creatively destroys it, and then provides incentives for researchers to come up with new ways of getting a kind of temporary advantage. Because the only way you get an advantage is if you know something somebody else doesn't know. But in the long term, everything gets taught, and so that initial advantage disappears. At least that's the story, right? That knowledge in the end of the day becomes universal. The teaching process is very important. So but that only works as long as research is able to flow into the teaching and not to be cut off from it. But as I've been saying, there are institutionally, universities are not working in a way to allow that to happen very effectively. Okay? Well, look, we'll stop here. And I will be sending off the course outline tonight. And so there are two entries in the knowledge book, University and Free Inquiry, that are relevant to what I've been saying here, and I will be sending something around with the course outline and some additional comments about what to look at in the seminars. Okay.